gitu ya.
Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, August 25th, 2014. Our opening audio today from an old Jethro Tull release called War Child. The sounds of mayhem, military action, airstrikes, death and destruction are being heard all over the planet these days, and it's hard to keep up with it all. I do my best to bring you what I think are the 10 most important stories that I'm aware of on any given day, complete with my ad-libbed commentary. And I thank you for joining me for today's News and Information podcast. And I want to lead with an excerpt from my in-depth interview earlier today with journalist Dar Jamail. Dar was a longtime contributor to our program during the invasion and occupation of Iraq, where he served as an unembedded independent journalist and filed many dispatches. He wrote a book about that. And in our conversation today, he describes what is counterintuitive to most Americans. And I'll let him say it, but to summarize it briefly, the more the United States is involved in military action in the Middle East, the less likely these conflicts will be resolved. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Dar Jamail.
Where you have senior Pentagon officials and some of the other talking heads in the administration saying things like, well, the Islamic State is now the biggest threat the U.S. faces, and which is absolutely baseless. I mean, first of all, if the U.S. is not in Iraq or not doing what they're doing in Syria, there is no U.S. person anywhere in that region, as long as they're not there, there's nobody that's under threat by the Islamic State. These people have not shown an inkling at all, aside from some bellicose rhetoric, of being able to carry out any kind of attack anywhere that's not in Syria and Iraq. Is it possible in the future that that might bleed into Lebanon or other countries in the region? Sure. But the U.S., that chance. I mean, this is just pure propaganda that is being used to try to drum up the support of the general public, which is loath given what's happened in Iraq, how many soldiers got killed, how many have come back, the tens of thousands that have come back to face the disaster that is the VA. We do not have a population in this country that is willing to support another big military misadventure in Iraq. And so they're doing the best they can as administration to try to drum up as much support as possible to do what they're doing already, which, of course, they still don't have that much support at all. And then again, the even greater task of trying to escalate that support to a level that might allow for a larger ground presence. Because, as I said before, they're not going to be able to destabilize the Islamic State without a lot of troops and military hardware on the ground. And so how are they going to work that politically, especially now with, you know, the campaign cycle for 2016 is going to be start ramping up this fall. You know, how are you going to do that? I mean, if the Obama administration did that, it would basically guarantee a lot of leverage, political leverage, for the Republicans to use during that campaign.
My wide-ranging interview about the Islamic State, about the situation in Iraq and Syria, and related issues, is available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And there's a lot in that conversation. One of the things we discuss is the advance by Islamic State fighters in Syria, where they captured a critical military base in the northern part of the country, which solidifies their control of Raqqa province. That abuts the Turkish border, and it's been a long headquarters for IIS, ISIS, ISIL, whatever you would like to call them. And this comes on the heels of the confrontation that they've had near the Mosul Dam, where they appear to be losing ground to U.S. airstrikes. But since we don't have any real reporters or other independent observers on the ground, we can only rely on Pentagon information, and it is sketchy about these issues. The United Nations on Sunday said it has evidence that fighters from the Islamic State killed over 600 prisoners in Mosul back in June when they took control of that northern Iraqi city. And the UN report goes into some detail about how people were rounded up, Shia were separated from Sunni, and the Shiites were given a number. And the last prisoner on that line was number 679. Those people were then loaded into trucks, driven out to a desert-like location, lined up in four rows, and executed. And the information comes from some people who played dead and actually survived that firing squad. Meanwhile, a week after we learned of the grisly execution of American journalist Jim Foley, claimed by Islamic State, one of the other factions apparently trying to gussy up its image, the Al-Nusra Front, released an American reporter, Peter Theo Curtis, and handed him over to UN peacekeepers close to the boundary between Israel and Syria at the Golan Heights. He's been held for almost 2 years. And the family had received ransom demands in the range of $3 to $25 million. Of course, the U.S. says we don't pay ransom and apparently didn't in this case. And as I mentioned, it appears that Al-Nusra, which is the one that has the affiliation with Al-Qaeda and which doesn't apparently operate in quite as bloodthirsty a way as IS does, they appear to be trying to make themselves look better in comparison, which is kind of an unusual PR objective. Meanwhile, there is unfortunately no news a month after an American from here in my community in Northern California, Jason Rezaian, and his foreign-born wife, Yagana Salehi, were taken into custody by authorities in Iran. There really has been no confirmation that they're being held, no discussion of what they might be charged for, and I wish I had more news there, but it simply isn't available. Over the weekend, in a spectacular bloody airstrike, Israeli warplanes and missiles took down an 11-story apartment tower in Gaza City. The hostilities there continue to escalate. There were more than 100 Hamas rockets fired into Israel today alone, we're told. As to that apartment tower in Gaza City, the Israelis maintain that it was a place where there were offices, and that's where some of the Hamas leaders met. But according to a man who used to have an apartment on the first floor, he said there were 42 apartments in the building. It's purely residential. There are no offices. And as for the Israelis' claim that the building housed a Hamas base, he said they are lying. Meanwhile, Mahmoud Abbas, who leads the Fatah faction of the Palestine government and nominally controls the West Bank, he has decided to go around United States-orchestrated peace efforts. He's launching his own initiative to be announced tomorrow. The details are still sketchy, but it sounds like he will call for an international conference or a United Nations resolution demanding a deadline to end Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory. And his leverage, Abbas is indicating that the Fatah wing of the Palestinian government will join the International Criminal Court in an effort to pursue Israel for criminal and war crimes violations. And while the U.S. says it wants to strengthen Abbas as the good Palestinian and punish Hamas as the bad Palestinian, the U.S. still objects to these moves because, well, Israel tells us to. And essentially, the leaders of Fatah are struggling to come up with something in order to pressure the Israelis to respond in some meaningful way. And so they're trying to come up with an either-or. Either Israel lifts the blockade and allows the Palestinians to develop some livable situation in the occupied areas, or the Palestinians will pursue a different path. I'm not sure it will gain much traction, but I'm certainly sympathetic to the desperation that Palestinians feel. Meanwhile, twice in the last 7 days, Egypt and the United Arab Emirates have secretly teamed up to launch airstrikes against Islamist-allied militias battling for control of Libya. The United States, we're told, was caught by surprise. Egypt and the Emirates, both close allies and military partners who we sell jets to, acted without informing Washington or seeking its consent to use those jets to conduct raids over Libya. And it's described by the New York Times as a shift from proxy wars, where regional powers play out their agendas through local allies, to direct involvement by Egypt and the Emirates. And this, as I'll detail in a moment, shows that the U.S. is losing whatever influence, whatever grip it had over many of these countries that we consider our allies in the Middle East. And so, for example, we have the report from Russia Today, the RT television network, that Iran has shot down an Israeli spy drone that was trying to penetrate the nuclear off-limits area of the Natanz nuclear installation. According to Reuters, quoting a statement by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, the downed aircraft was of the stealth radar evasive type. It intended to penetrate the off-limit nuclear area in Natanz, but was targeted by a ground-to-air missile and taken down. However, Iran doesn't tell us exactly when this happened. Meanwhile, on the other side of the earth, at least from me, China sent a jet fighter up to say hi to a couple of U.S. Navy surveillance planes, a P-8 Poseidon and a P-3 Orion. In fact, the Chinese fighter jet got within 30 feet of these American surveillance craft. Now, I don't know exactly where this took place. They say near the Chinese coast. And it is not clear if this was in international airspace or perhaps disputed airspace. But it shows that tensions are running high, and there's a kind of recklessness that appears to be occurring, where nations that used to at least publicly have some deference to the United States seem to be flexing their own muscles. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Abby McMillan, who voluntarily spends more than she has to for a subscription to these podcasts. I also want to thank Alan Van Tress, Sharon Gadberry, and the fine folks at Lightworks Art. You make this all possible, help me cover the costs. I want to invite those of you who are not currently supporting me. There's no guilt trip. I'm not going to play like reader-supported news and tell you that we're about to close our doors. But I do need your help because subscribers, for whatever reason, often stay for a while and then they cancel. I've had a few cancellations recently. I would like you to replace them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Follow the link under my picture that says sign up. And you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers in the U.S., get a copy of our bonus CD, The Rock and Roll Red Flag, from our friend John Dist. Well, there's some high-stakes political games being played in France and in Ukraine. Both leaders have called for new elections, they are new cabinets, new governments, and in each case they are dissolving the cabinet or the parliament they have, and hoping to form a new government. In the case of France, Hollande, Francois Hollande, who is, his approval ratings are at 17%. He has decided to eject from his cabinet those who have objected to the austerity programs that France has imposed at the bidding of Germany. And Hollande seems to be rolling the dice here to see if he can form a government entirely comprised of people who agree with his pro-business, pro-international corporate point of view. And over in Ukraine, I honestly don't know enough about how it should be working to tell you how unusual it might be, but President Poroshenko, the candy billionaire, has dissolved the parliament, and he is trying to form a new government more to his liking as well. And of course, particularly in Ukraine, this stretches the definition of the term democracy. Because, of course, there was a coup that the United States supported back in February or March. And then the Crimean referendum, which was hardly democratic. And then in Kiev, they rammed through elections. But it's really hard to consider these processes truly democratic. And that's what makes it even more difficult to know whether, in the case of Ukraine, Poroshenko's move will actually promote stability in a very volatile situation. News from Silicon Valley, where we have been telling you for years now that Steve Jobs and other CEOs of tech giants in the Valley colluded in a deal where they agreed not to try to raid each other's engineering departments. And Jobs was very protective of his workers. He didn't want them poached by competitors because, gosh, that might cause them to ask him for more money. And while Silicon Valley engineers are not underpaid, their contributions to the billions in profit made by companies like Apple, well, they rarely trickle down to the worker bees. And so we have the case of Judge Lucy Koh, who rejected a settlement on behalf of a class action, a class action suit, saying that it wasn't enough. It didn't provide adequate compensation to those who were screwed by this high-level cartel. So now we have shareholders who have sued the estate of St. Steve Jobs and individual board members of Apple Computer. And they're saying that Apple was part of a secret wage-fixing cartel and that members of the board failed to disclose to shareholders an investigation into that cartel or a settlement reached with the Department of Justice. And I think this is a very interesting approach. I personally believe that suing the members of corporate boards of directors is one of the best ways that we can try to regain some control over these runaway operations. And what I mean by that is that most often, the members of the boards of directors are cronies of the executive management of a company. And so when they meet to decide compensation, they do so in the interests of their buddy who put them on the board and not the shareholders to whom they have a fiduciary responsibility. Now, I believe if we held directors accountable for that fiduciary responsibility, that they wouldn't allow companies to engage in these kind of wage-fixing cartels, and they wouldn't keep showering CEOs with cash income and stock options that essentially are fleeced from the ordinary shareholders of a company. Well, Al Sharpton is a busy man. On Saturday, he led a march described with tens of thousands of people in Staten Island, a part of New York City. This was a protest over the police choking of Eric Garner. He was the one who was captured, and we saw him taken down on camera. His crime was he had been selling loose cigarettes. And the exchange between him and the officers was quite remarkable. as he pleaded with them, and they ignored him and then brutally took him down, and he ended up choking to death. And I have to say, when Al Sharpton enters a controversy, my hackles go up. I really don't like Al Sharpton. I've met him a few times. I've talked with him. But he is a serial media opportunist. And now that he somehow got MSNBC to give him an hour a day on at least nationally distributed television, he's got this forum and he continues to operate his nonprofit group. And it's uncomfortable for me because, I'm a radio host and an activist, but I do draw a sharp distinction between those two roles. And I think Al Sharpton mixes them up. And because of his sordid history of, in particular, the Tawana Brawley case, well, when Al Sharpton shows up, I get concerned. At any rate, he was in Staten Island on Saturday and today in the St. Louis suburbs, where he was one of those who delivered a eulogy at the funeral of Michael Brown. And Michael Brown deserves to be honored. Again, when Al Sharpton enters the picture, one asks, well, is this about Michael Brown or is this about Al Sharpton and his ego? Nevertheless, speaking before the overflowing crowd, Sharpton criticized the militarization of the police, their treatment of Michael Brown, while also calling on African Americans to push for change instead of, quote, sitting around having ghetto pity parties. Well, somebody ought to get him a copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People. But speaking of that police militarization, as you know, I believe that one of the unintended benefits of the Michael Brown controversy and the disturbances that were prompted by it is the exposure of this expansive, militarized police state in the U.S. I know a lot of people got a glimpse of that, and it made them squirm. And I don't know if it made President Obama squirm, but he saw enough of the rest of us squirming that he decided to pay lip service to this issue of militarized local law enforcement. And so he has ordered a comprehensive review of the government's decade-old strategy of outfitting local police departments with military-grade body armor, mine-resistant trucks, silencers, automatic rifles, and let's not forget the Stingray surveillance system and all of the other toys and accessories that have been showered on local law enforcement by the federal government. And I guess I'm getting really jaded here because I hear Obama's going to do a comprehensive review. My first reaction is, well, that way we know absolutely nothing will happen. Look at his comprehensive review with his buddy Cass Sunstein and four or five other guys of the NSA's illegal wiretapping program. What have we gotten from that? Oh, there's some bills pending. But nothing has happened. There has been no real reform of NSA surveillance of innocent Americans in 14 months since Ed Snowden put his life on the line and his future on the line to try to warn us about it. And so we've got to look to other leaders. Obama will only make changes in this creeping police state if members of his own political party force the issue. It's an election year. You have a chance to put pressure on those members of the president's party. And I hope you will. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast, and you're authorized to share it with absolutely everyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.